From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new president goes south of the border. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama defended his tax policies today. Tomorrow, he'll head for Mexico and then to the Caribbean for the Summit of the Americas. After 6 years of growth, Latin America is hard hit by the recession, and leaders are looking for help from a new U.S. president who's popular in their countries. Will Obama seize the chance to re-engage? Will he be upstaged by Venezuela's Hugo Chavez? What about Cuba? In addition to supporting President Calderon's war on drugs, will Obama push for reforms in Mexico's justice system? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a bad day for Somali pirates. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Obama will stop in Mexico on his way to the Summit of the Americas. Will it be a symbolic exercise or the start of a new era in U.S. relations with Latin America? On Reporter's Notebook, one ship escaped, a U.S. ship, and 11 pirates have been captured in the Indian Ocean. First, this news update. With conservative media pushing anti-tax tea parties on this day the taxes are due, President Obama addressed the issue this morning.
For too long, we've seen taxes used as a wedge to scare people into supporting policies that actually increase the burden on working people instead of helping them live their dreams. That has to change.
David K. Johnston is a former tax reporter for the New York Times. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He writes the column for Tax Notes and teaches at the Syracuse University Law School, and it's always good to have him on our program. David K. Johnston, welcome.
Well, thank you, Warren.
The president apparently trying to turn the tables on the tea parties by saying that taxes are being used as a wedge to scare people into supporting the wrong policies.
Well, indeed, and one of the things about the people running these tea parties is they haven't studied their history very carefully. The Boston Tea Party was a protest against taxation without representation. We certainly have taxation with representation, with the consent of the governed. But more importantly, it wasn't a protest against high taxes. It was a protest against a tax favor, a tax giveaway to the politically connected friends of King George III. That was done in a way that would create a monopoly in the colonies and raise the price of tea through this tax favor. And what is it we've been through years of now in Congress? Congress giving away favors to their campaign donors that have pushed the burden onto the rest of us. So their protest is a little ahistorical.
What about the tax cuts that have been enacted already by the bills that the president has signed? Withholding is already going down.
Yes, withholding is going down, and the president also signed a series of business tax cuts. 40% of the stimulus package was business tax cuts. By their nature, those are savings when stimulus package is supposed to produce spending. What we have, the definition of what's going on right now is a lack of demand. So that's not going to help with demand. Individuals are going to see their withholding go down. They will get some benefit from that. But what the president briefly mentioned this morning was fundamental tax reform. There's no way between now and December 4th, when Paul Volcker is supposed to report back, that they can do the work for fundamental tax reform. But they certainly could make a lot of improvements in our ridiculously complicated system.
Back to the tea parties. Even though the taxes are going down at the moment, they will be going up for some of the wealthiest Americans. And, of course, there will be a major deficit increase because of the spending.
Well, there will. In the short run, almost across the board, economists agree you need to have spending to make up for this collapse of demand. The way we're doing the spending, unfortunately, is concentrating more money in the hands of a narrow group of people, bankers, Wall Street investment groups, et cetera, not through things like significantly raising unemployment benefits to the millions of Americans who are out of work through no fault of their own, which would have a much better stimulative effect on the economy. Also, Warren, understand that President Obama is proposing the biggest tax cut in history. He's described all the time in the news as raising taxes. The Bush tax cuts were temporary. They expire at the end of next year. They represent a $3 trillion tax cut. But without them, taxes are going to go up by trillions of dollars. Obama is proposing a $2 trillion tax cut and permanent cuts, unlike the Bush cuts.
Let me ask you this. An ABC Post, Washington Post poll asked this question. Do you think that the president is an old-style tax-and-spend Democrat? Just 32% said they did. 62% said he's a new-style Democrat who will be careful with the public's money. Given all of the recent publicity and news coverage, are you surprised by that?
No, I'm not. I think, you remember, this is a man who started out in life as a community organizer in the city, and so he has a different perspective. Unfortunately, he has surrounded himself with people whose jobs were either paid for by Wall Street. Larry Summers, his chief economic advisor, got $5 million for a one-day-a-week job last year, and others who are connected with the problems we have. And what he doesn't have around him are people speaking out on behalf of working Americans, so that he hears from them a different way to solve the economic problems that he inherited.
So the president himself appears to be very credible with the American people. You have some question, however, about the people that he has advising him.
Absolutely. I think that there's much too much influence here to Wall Street, much too concerned about the bankers, not about individual Americans. And the other big issue that needs to be discussed.
David K. Johnston, we seem to have lost him, but at a fortuitous time because we're just about out of time for this particular segment. Again, David K. Johnston, a former New York Times Pulitzer Prize winner. His book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, now also teaching at the Syracuse University Law School. In a moment, a new president goes south of the border. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. On a trip to Chile, Vice President Biden met with the leaders of several Latin American countries, but on his way to the summit of the Americas, President Obama will visit just one. Tomorrow, he makes his first trip to Mexico. Andres Rosenthal is former deputy foreign minister and ambassador at large in Mexico. And Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for being on our program.
You're quite welcome. It's a pleasure.
Do you think that Mexico is being singled out by this visit, the only one the president himself will make to any of the Latin American countries?
Well, it's a tradition for new U.S. presidents to travel to Mexico first before they visit any other country in Latin America. And since President Obama has to go to Trinidad and Tobago for the Summit of the Americas just after this visit, it's, I think, fairly traditional that he should have stopped in Mexico before that. But I also think that it's an extremely important visit, coming as it does on the heels of a series of visits that we had by Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Homeland Security Napolitano, Attorney General Holder, all designed to discuss the bilateral relationship on the issues of migration, the trucking issue, and of course the increasing violence and problems related to the drug cartels.
We hear a lot about the drug cartels. We hear a lot about migration as well. Explain to our listeners, what's the issue with regard to trucking?
It's a long-standing issue. When NAFTA was negotiated and entered into force 15 years ago, the treaty provided for a phase-in period of 5 years for Mexican and U.S. trucks to be able to cross the border and operate in each other's jurisdictions. The United States did not fulfill this commitment, mainly because of the opposition by the Teamsters Union, and lost two arbitration awards that were settled under the NAFTA dispute settlement procedures, but still refused to implement the NAFTA provisions. A pilot program was put up just to see that Mexican trucks were able to do this, that they met all the safety standards and all of the different requirements that Mexican trucks would need to have to be able to circulate in the United States. Some 100 trucks met those requirements, began to circulate, and then all of a sudden Congress cut off the funding for this pilot program, which was summarily discontinued by Obama administration. As a result of that, the Mexican government, under NAFTA and fully in compliance with NAFTA, decided to put together some compensatory, retaliatory tariff increases on U.S. exports to Mexico. So this is an issue that needs to be resolved.
Could this actually lead to a trade war between Mexico and the United States?
No, I wouldn't call it a trade war. I don't think that's what it is, because trade wars are usually on the basis of looking for protectionist advantage, if you like. Our treaty, our North American Free Trade Arrangement, precludes trade wars between us. What it does do is it allows one country to apply tariffs to compensate for losses, for example, in this case, from trade that would normally take place in trucks that were able to cross the border freely.
Let me ask you about another subject. On an American television station, a program, CBS Face the Nation, this week, the current ambassador, Arturo Saru Khan, was asked if it would help with regard to the drug traffic if the United States legalized marijuana. He didn't say no. He said that that's an issue that needs to be seriously considered. Do you agree?
I certainly do, and I have been on record as having said that the only real solution to the problem that has arisen, if you like, recently in terms of public opinion and media coverage, but it's something that's been around for quite some time, is to revisit the whole issue of drug policy, not just in the United States or Mexico, but globally, worldwide. I think that, you know, it's not enough just to think about what you do in one country, whether it's a consuming country, a producing country, or a transit country, but rather to see whether, as an international community, we are doing the right thing by trying to interdict drug consumption by interdicting drug production. And it hasn't worked. I mean, it's very clear that over the years, there's been no significant reduction in drug demand. There has been no significant reduction in the flows of drugs. There's been some change in the types of drugs. But by and large, over the last decades, we've seen that there is a demand and that demand is going to be met independently of where it comes from. So, yes, I very much agree that we need to revisit this whole issue. And one of the things is to begin to discriminate among drugs and look at the ones that are least harmful, as we do with other substances like alcohol and tobacco and other things, rather than to continue to try to fight it by interdicting it and the enormous cost that has had in terms of lives, in terms of financial resources and human resources.
Ambassador Andres Rosenthal, again, former Deputy Foreign Minister of Mexico, also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. John Ackerman is professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's also a columnist for Proceso magazine and La Jornada newspaper. John Ackerman, good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren. A pleasure to speak with you.
As the ambassador said, Hillary Clinton was in Mexico recently. Did anything that she said indicate that the United States might be open to the idea of reviewing drug policy in the way the ambassador suggests?
Well, no. Hillary Clinton's visit was a step forward. It was a different face of the United States for Mexicans to see. She was explicitly recognizing the responsibility of the United States in the problem in Mexico, both with regard to the flow of money south by drug users and the flow of weapons to the south. Both this money and these weapons are basically arming and strengthening this the power of the drug cartels and making the situation much worse in Mexico. And it was a good sign that Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration was recognized this. But beyond that, it didn't seem like there was a major agenda change. Of course, legalization was not spoken about at all, nor was she even willing to talk about the possibility of bringing back the weapons ban, the assault weapons ban, which would also be a major step forward in this combat against the narcos.
Apparently, the administration and Hillary Clinton's visit would give some force to this idea, is prepared to stand with President Calderon in his fight with the drug cartels. Is that what Mexicans want to see?
Well, I think that's a complicated issue, Warren. I think we need to think about it carefully, because it's important to distinguish between Calderon and Mexico, even between Calderon and the government. There are lots of different parts of government, branches of government, and Calderon by no means represents the entire Mexican state. There's also been serious criticisms of the strategy that President Calderon has used. He has rolled the military out into the streets, but in many ways this quote-unquote war on drugs, which I think it's a mistake to call it a war on drugs, has been carried out in a way very similar to George Bush's war in Iraq, very much for political motives. Calderon has gone to military posturing as a way of trying to beef up his political legitimacy, but that's not necessarily the way in which we can resolve the problem here in Mexico. I mean, on the United States side, we've talked about deeper solutions. In Mexico, there also are deeper solutions. For instance, combating corruption, making the Attorney General's office more efficient, putting people actually into jail. It doesn't really help too much to capture these narco leaders if, in the end, they're let free and they're not actually remain in jail.
Well, should the President of the United States push for a different kind of justice system or a more effective justice system in Mexico?
Yes, I think there's a broader agenda that Obama could talk about if he was interested in doing so tomorrow when he comes down here. It's not just about tanks and guns and bullets. It's about a more deep solution, which could would have to do with combating corruption and also defending human rights. Right, one of the major problems with Calderon's strategy, he now has 45,000 troops in the streets, is that the amount of human rights violations has gone up remarkably over the last 2 years. And so we really have sort of a state of emergency in parts of Mexico which have not been formally legally determined, but in which the president unilaterally has been imposing this very particular view of how to fight crime and drugs on the Mexican people.
Professor John Ackerman, again at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Back to Ambassador Andres Rosenthal. What do you have to say to that? Is this something that the President of the United States could appropriately bring up with the President of Mexico?
Well, he can certainly bring it up, but I disagree with Professor Ackerman, because I don't think that this is an issue, as it wouldn't be appropriate for President Calderon to bring up issues within the United States that are, to some extent, they're relevant, if you like, but they're not immediately directly connected to the bilateral agenda. I mean, we've always had, and there continues to be, a clear understanding in Mexico that we have issues on the human rights side, on democracy, on other things, the justice system, that require a great deal of work. I don't think that it's a question that we need to be lectured on it by the United States.
John Ackerman, back to you. Do you think, then, that the United States probably has gone about as far as it's going to go?
No, well, I think this is an important thing to talk about, because one thing is for, Obama and the U.S. government is very much directly participating in what happens in Mexico. There's a $1.4 billion funding coming down from the United States to Mexico on the Merida Plan. And the idea that this money can only go to military intervention and not larger institutional transformation, I think, is a little bit strange. Why is it somehow an intervention in Mexico's internal affairs to be talking about issues of human rights and corruption when it's not intervention into Mexico's internal affairs to talk about tanks and helicopters? I think Obama needs to rethink, and he's trying to do so, the way in which we the United States can support foreign governments and foreign peoples. And this is sort of the idea of the old ideas, of the idea the only the central line or issue for foreign policy needs to be military support. I think we need to go beyond that and think of a more open and long-term structural transformation that the United States and Mexico are partners on and can work together on.
Well, thank you both for talking about Mexico. John Ackerman, again, at the National Autonomous University and Proceso Magazine, and La Jornada newspaper, also Ambassador Andres Rosenthal. Good to have you both with us. Let me turn now to the next step in the president's trip will be, as we heard, in Trinidad and Tobago, where the Summit of the Americas will take place. Julia Swag is Director of Latin Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Friendly Fire, Losing Friends and Making Enemies in the Anti-American Century. She's also written two books on Cuba. And Julia Swag, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you again. Thank you.
This week, the president has changed policy with regard to Cuban Americans. They can now make unlimited trips back to Cuba, and they have no limits on the amount of money that they can send to their relatives and friends in that country. As the president goes to the summit, how do you think that those changes will be received by the other leaders?
Well, the changes are limited, as you noted, to Cuban Americans. I think, although domestically in the United States, the storyline has been that this is a really big deal, that now Cuban Americans can travel and send money to their relatives. Outside of the United States, it's going to look like pretty small bore. I mean, it looks like that to me. I should just say that the fact that they had the legal authority to extend for all Americans certain, not unlimited, but certain rights to travel to Cuba and didn't do it makes this really smell like domestic politics if we look only at the travel package, which I think is what's going to get featured also by the Latin American observers. But they also opened a door to allow Americans to do business in Cuba in telecommunications. It depends who the Latin Americans are. Chavez might describe this as too little too late, as others have. On the other hand, you might have a Lula or a Calderon who will look at this and say, it's a small step forward, and we hope there will be more.
Do you think it's likely that Hugo Chavez will use the opportunity at the summit to try to draw attention to himself and to embarrass or be critical of President Obama?
I don't know if it's likely. Of course, it's always possible. He seems ambivalent about what kind of relationship he wants to have with Obama. But I do think that there's been lots of messages going to Chavez from a variety of different sources, imploring him to please not put on the kind of show that we saw at Mar del Plata. And we'll just have to see it. Nobody knows until we see it.
That was the last summit of the Americas.
That's
what,
right.
What actually, we only have a minute left before we need to go to a break, but quickly, what did he do?
Well, he rented booked a large stadium nearby and sort of had his own huge public gathering with Evo Morales, and I believe Fidel Castro was there as well. And he just put on a very loud anti-American show. Now, it wasn't only Chavez that was doing that. And remember, this was sort of the nadir of American standing in the region. George Bush was very unpopular. Obama's a completely different kettle of fish, and I think the Latin Americans, even Chavez, we'll be very happy just to get a chance to see the man face to face.
Julia Swag at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief break and return and continue this conversation. On Reporter's Notebook, attempted piracy has been foiled today in the Indian Ocean. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Once again, President Obama going to Mexico tomorrow, then on to the Summit of the Americas in the Caribbean. We're talking now with Julia Swag, Director of Latin Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You said that the leaders in general will, even Hugo Chavez, be welcoming a change in the United States. You mentioned a couple of others, Lula da Silva of Brazil, Evo Morales of Bolivia. What are the differences between the major leaders, the leaders of the biggest countries in Latin America?
The differences in their attitudes towards the United States?
Yes.
Let's see. Brazil, Lula. Lula, as you know, comes from a background himself of poor working class leader of the PT, the Workers' Party. His party governed at the local and regional level for years. Finally, after a couple of tries, he won the presidency. He now presides over the eighth largest economy in the world and is in the process of trying to establish Brazil not just as a regional leader, Brazil has 10 countries on its border, but as a global leader on major global issues such as climate change, the financial crisis in the G20, and as importantly as a strategic partner of the United States. So Lula comes to the table wanting the summit very much, wanting to demonstrate at the summit that he not only is a regional leader in South America, but also can help the United States manage issues and relationships such as the Cuba issue, such as the relationship with Venezuela. Mexico, I'm sure that Andres and John have spoken about this already, likewise sees itself as an interlocutor between the Americas and the United States, and as an incredibly important partner, a strategic partner perhaps, but one that, since it shares a 2,000-mile border, unlike Brazil, has many bilateral issues that it has to tend to, as this visit is demonstrating. Then you've got a smaller country such as Colombia. President Uribe was, of course, denoted by President Bush as America's best friend in the region, and I think he in Latin America, and he's now going to be suffering, I think, from the end of best friendism, if I could call it that way, and trying to recalibrate the relationship that Colombia seeks from Washington. The best example will be, is he going to get the trade agreement that's now stalled in Congress, but also the shape of Plan Colombia, which is not exactly like the Merida initiative, but is the big anti-narcotics counter-terror policy that started 10 years ago that is in the process of slowly winding down. That's just a few examples.
Yeah, and good ones. Julia Swag, again, with the Council on Foreign Relations. Paulo Sotero is director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington. He was Washington correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo newspaper in Brazil, and it's good to have you on our program.
A pleasure to be with you.
Do you agree that Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, the other of the four leaders that we've talked about, is not likely to raise some sort of diversion, I guess you could call it, at the summit, or do you think he will?
I think it's more likely that he won't, because Hugo Chavez is facing a series of problems at home that derive from the fall of oil revenue income that he used to exercise leadership in the region, to pay for programs, to support political and other initiatives. Also, Hugo Chavez must be aware that the person that he will be talking to is not the unpopular George W. Bush, is rather the very popular, very attractive figure of President Barack Obama, a leader that is seen in a positive light by most people's societies in Latin America, by most leaders in Latin America. As President Lula says, we are all praying for his success as president, especially in the economy, because Obama's success in the United States will translate into tremendous benefits to Brazil and to the other countries.
Do you think that Lula da Silva is, in fact, likely to get what he wants, to emerge from this as a strategic partner of the United States, and particularly on these issues of the climate change and the financial situation?
Well, I don't think that Lula needs the summit to assert that. I think Lula is already there. He has established, I think, a very positive relationship with President Obama. Brazil has to be at the table at any meaningful discussion on climate change. It is a challenge for Brazil also domestically, but Brazil has to be there. Brazil is sitting at the table looking now to reform the international financial system. Brazil is a member of the G20 countries alongside with others that met with President Obama. This will be his third meeting with President Obama in a little bit more than a month. So I think you should expect Brazil to play a very positive role in this. Having said that, let me clarify that this is not the preferred format of meeting for Brazil. Brazil doesn't feel comfortable as being one of a bunch Brazil doesn't like anything that's hemispheric in nature. And actually, the criticism in Brazil is that this meeting of the Americas here in the 6th Summit of the Americas in Trinidad, that will happen this time in Trinidad, is sort of a meeting format looking for a vocation, because there isn't, beyond meeting President Obama, for the leaders that have not done that so far, there isn't much substance in the meeting.
Julius Wai, I get back to you with the Council on Foreign Relations. Do you agree there's not much substance to the meeting, that it's likely to be more a opportunity for networking?
Yes, I fully agree with Paolo. I'm a deep summit skeptic. I have to confess that they're news hooks, so they provide a good opportunity for all of us to talk about the region and our relationship with one another. They come early in this presidency, as one came early in the Bush presidency. The networking, the getting to know you, and I think the symbolism too of the president just showing up. He's not familiar with Latin America. It's really his cotillion there, and that's quite enough. And I think they'll get a little bit more. So with expectations low and the sort of a bit of a cacophonous circus nature, it's inevitable when you get all that people, huge delegations, lots of press. I think the expectations should be focused rather on the policies and relationships that come afterwards.
Before I let you go, why is it that after so short a time in office, President Obama seems to wield enormous influence already with the leaders of South America?
Actually, I'm not sure that I agree with the premise of that question. Sorry to sound so wonky in my answer, but I think Latin Americans see Obama, as many Americans do, as embodying the American dream. His storyline is incredible, and the mere fact that the American populace elected him helped enormously in just beginning to recover our standing, which collapsed globally and in Latin America in the last 8 years. But influence, that's a different question entirely. Latin America, South America has declared its independence from the United States in terms of foreign policy, has ties globally, investment and trade and diplomatic ties. So he might get a hearing for sure, but this is not the olden days when an American president could go down to Latin America with a smorgasbord of policies and say, look, here, take it or leave it. And I don't think that's what we're going to get from this president either, nor is that what is expected.
So we're going to see a new era, but it's not necessarily by choice.
Well, it's a product of the acceleration of a process already underway. I mean, in fact, you know, the more democratic Latin America has become, the more the governments have to respond to their own electorates first and foremost, and not to Washington. And this is probably a process that was accelerated by the falling out with George Bush over foreign policy generally, not just his policies toward Latin America. It's a new era, but I actually think that Washington will welcome it, because Washington is fundamentally growing out of its Monroe Doctrine impulses, I think. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but I think so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Julius Swag, Director of Latin Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Friendly Fire, Losing Friends and Making Enemies in the Anti-American Century. Paolo Sotero with the Brazil Center is still with us. Let me introduce, before we go further, Claudio Loser. He is a senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, former director of the Western Hemisphere Department of the International Monetary Fund, and it's good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
How important is the financial situation to the countries of Latin America? They've been pretty prosperous over the past 6 years.
Yes. The last 6 years have been tremendously prosperous for the world overall, and Latin America benefited from that. Of course, the Latin Americans, as many others, thought that this was really self-generated when it was really part of the global situation. Now, Latin America has built better foundations over the last 6 years to confront the crisis, but maybe belatedly, except for Mexico that received the shock very quickly, belatedly the rest of Latin America, from Brazil to Argentina to all the countries in the Caribbean, etc., have been hit by this global recession, And so they find themselves with trade going down, with financing from the private banks that they were receiving enormous amounts of money, $150 billion a year or so of private money. Now they find that they don't have this available. So it is quite a shock for them. And I think that other than all the politics that were mentioned by Paulo and Julia, the economic aspect will be tremendously important.
What is it that they would like the U.S. to do?
Well, the first thing they want the U.S. to do is what the U.S. wants to do, that the U.S. economy improves, because it has been shown that the U.S. is still an important motor of growth, although it is shrunk in relative importance. The second aspect is that the U.S. and the Latin Americans, as a counterpart, do not start a trade war. We heard about Mexico and tracking and all this. And I think that this is tremendously important, that the U.S. pushes the free trade agreements with Colombia and Panama, although this will not be important in this case, but also that they do not impose additional restrictions. And of course, the Latin Americans are not poor countries that don't do anything and are victims, as sometimes we like to present ourselves, but it is also that they have to do their job. And the third one is to make as much money as possible available from the G20 meeting. Remember, the G20 meeting a few weeks ago talked about $1.1 trillion of available resources. My calculation is that the Latin Americans could get over the next 2 years about $150 to $180 billion, which is a lot of money for the region.
We heard earlier about leaders of Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela. We have not heard about the leaders of your country, or leader of your country, which is Argentina. Tell us a bit.
Okay. Argentina is in a difficult situation. They have prospered enormously through the boom of commodities. They have suffered now a lot. They have internal problems. The idea was always before for the Kirchners to show an image of sort of great independence. In recent months, with the economy sort of weakening and having problems with money, Argentina, which is still the third largest economy in Latin America, has had to modify its views. And so it cannot have, unfortunately, it has lost the role that it used to have, and it certainly cannot have the role of Mexico or Brazil. But still, Cristina Kirchner will come and will be sort of trying forming a team with Brazil. It used to be more with Venezuela, but the relations, it's something very important from an economic and political point of view, is that the summit cannot be seen only as an opportunity for the U.S. to meet with Canadians and Latin Americans and the U.S. in the middle, but there are all these conflicts among Latin American countries, and this will come to the fore as well. And Argentina has its issues with Uruguay, has now its issues with Venezuela, tensions of trade with regard to Brazil. In general, the Spanish-speaking countries are a bit suspicious about Brazil taking the leadership vis-a-vis the U.S. So there are complexities that really make this summit, I think, much more interesting than what many people expect.
Claudio Losar, again, at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, formerly with the IMF. Back to Paulo Sotero at the Brazil Institute. What about trade? Do you think that it will be possible to make agreements, or given the situation of the global economy, will everybody be seeking some form of protection?
The best that we can hope for is for the leaders to reassert what the G20 leader said, is to fight against protectionism. There is no room for countries to move in the direction of freer trade. This is a toxic issue in most countries now in the context of this global recession. Freer trade was actually the motive of the first summit of the Americas back in December of 1994, that met in Miami. Now, there are two things that show the limits, what can be achieved here concretely in terms of the economic situation. One, the very lengthy 94-paragraph communique of the meeting that was negotiated before in the past few weeks doesn't deal with the global crisis, basically. It's almost embarrassing. The other aspect that is important to call attention to is that no country has volunteered to host the next summit of the Americas so far. So if this doesn't happen, we may very well see this as the last summit of a series. Now, as Claudio mentioned, it is important as an event. It's an important networking event where people can get a better understanding of issues and normally moved into a negotiating mode. I think that's what also President Obama and President Lula and others bring. You know, it's a willingness to resolve issues through a understanding negotiations. Very important that President Obama said, you know, the world has changed, the United States has to change with the world, and he has said he comes to this meeting to listen to people. Oh. This is very new coming from an American president.
Back to Claudio Loser. 94 paragraphs, no mention of the world economic crisis. That doesn't suggest that there's going to be a lot coming out of this meeting.
Well, of course, you can always add a second, a 95th and 96th paragraph. And I think that is easy because it will be, from the substantive point of view, the international crisis is the dominant element, other than sort of Obama's first visit to the region. So I think it is a terrible mistake not to include it, considering that this is what is affecting it, both the U.S. and Latin America, with negative growth in all cases. So I would say that this will have to be corrected very quickly.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. Claudia Losader at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, formerly with the IMF. Paulo Sotero at the Brazil Institute, a former Washington correspondent for one of the big Brazilian newspapers. And thanks to our other guests as well, Julia Swag at the Council on Foreign Relations, John Ackerman at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, and Ambassador Andres Rosenthal, formerly the Deputy Foreign Minister of Mexico. Somali pirates vowed revenge against the U.S. after Navy snipers killed three of their number this week. But in the Indian Ocean yesterday, it was a bad day for pirates, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. An American cargo ship, the Liberty Sun, was fired upon yesterday by pirates in the Indian Ocean and hit by bullets and rockets. Somehow, the vessel escaped. Meantime, the French Defense Ministry says one of its warships captured 11 pirates on a so-called mother ship off the coast of Kenya. Shashank Bengali is Africa correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers, and it's good to have you back on our program. Let's talk first about the Liberty Sun. It appeared from what the pirates have been quoted as saying that they were really just shooting at it. They didn't intend to try to take it over. This was retaliation for the killings that occurred earlier this week. What appears to you to be the case?
Well, Warren, it's interesting. You know, the pirates have been vowing to take revenge and to show that they are still able to attack ships on the high seas despite the U.S. military action on Sunday. And certainly, they've not been deterred. In fact, they've stepped up their attacks. It's hard to know at the moment because the Liberty Sun hasn't yet arrived in port. The crew has not been speaking to press yet. It's hard to know what actually happened. It's often the case that pirates, are not able to flag down a ship or to stop a ship because the waters are so choppy, and sometimes their little speedboats that they operate in get slapped around by the waves. So it's not clear. It's clear that the ship came under attack by rockets. But it's not clear what the pirates' intention was. They could just be saying they didn't want to get the ship because they in the end, didn't get the ship.
There was this communication from one of the crewmen. Apparently, we are barricaded in the engine room. So far, nobody's hurt. A rocket penetrated the bulkhead, but the hole is small. A small fire, too, but it was put out. So there certainly was some action going on.
This is true, and I think what we're seeing, based on this report from the crew member in an email on the Liberty Sun and what we heard from the crew of the Maersk Alabama, the ship that was the hijackers were deterred from taking last week, that there are procedures that these crews are being trained in and are following, one of which seems to be if you come under attack to hide and barricade yourself in a safe room or an engine room. We've seen both the American ships, the Liberty Sun and the Maersk Alabama, do just that.
What about the 11 pirates that the French say they took capturing a mothership?
This is what happened today. Yes, the French military is one of the militaries that are on the Indian Ocean patrolling, trying to deter pirates, and they've taken the lead. They've arrested 11 pirates, and they're saying that they want to try these pirates in France. This is interesting because the U.S. Government has a dilemma now. They have a pirate, the surviving pirate of the four that hijacked the Maersk Alabama last week and held Captain Richard Phillips hostage. The fourth pirate who wasn't killed is on the USS Bainbridge destroyer that's coming into Mombasa today with Captain Phillips, we understand. That pirate is in U.S. military custody, and there's some debate as to whether he should be tried in the U.S. or whether they'll leave him in Kenya to be tried here in Kenya. And the U.S. hasn't made it clear what they want to do yet. This will be the first pirate trial in the U.S. In more than 200 years, at least, and we don't really know what the Justice Department has decided. They've been kept very mum about their intentions. Clearly, the pirate seems to be quite young. We think he's a teenager, and it's not clear if there will be issues about trying a minor, if he's under 18, and these kinds of things. So those issues appear to have not been resolved yet by the U.S. government.
You said one alternative might be to try him in Kenya. What are the Kenyans saying about it?
The Kenyans have quite a number of pirates in custody. What seems to happen, Warren, is when these international navies that are on the Indian Ocean that have been patrolling for the past several months, when they arrest pirates, many of them, including Germany, for example, other countries that have arrested pirates. Mombasa, Kenya, where I'm talking to you now from, is the major port of call in the region, and this is a place where a lot of the pirates have ended up. There's at least a couple dozen pirates in custody, in prison here. The trials take a long time. The Kenyan justice system is sort of overburdened, and we spoke to a lawyer today for a group of pirates that was apprehended in February. They have not had their day in court. It's been a couple of months. They've only seen their lawyer a couple of times. The Kenyans don't seem to be eager to take on a lot of cases of pirates, but they also want to be seen to be doing their job and to be participating in policing the high seas off their coast. So it's not clear what the Kenyans want, but they would probably not want to have a lot of pirates showing up on their doorstep. And if other countries are willing to take on these cases, I'm sure they would welcome that.
What's the significance of the French taking over the mother ship? Is that a first, or is that something that's happened before?
It's happened before. We know that the mother ships seem to be, they seem to have several, pirate speedboats attached to them. And mother ships seem to be also a communications point between pirates on the ground who relay information. Then, there's the mother ship that gets that information by satellite phone about where ships are in the Indian Ocean, and then they send out these little pirate skiffs. So it's sort of a part of a layer of organization that that the pirate groups seem to have.
If you
can arrest one of those ships, it means you're sort of nipping one pirate group in the bud, so to speak.
By capturing the ship, is that does that make it easier, perhaps, to trace back to whoever it is on shore that's financing the operation?
Possibly, although it's such a murky world in Somalia. You know, very little is written down. There are no records to speak of. You know, these ships, the mother ships, often tend to be other ships that have been hijacked as well. You know, that have been seized and that that haven't been returned. Sometimes the pirates, especially smaller craft like yachts and things, we've known of cases in the past where pirate groups have used those ships as mother ships because they're easier to maneuver and a little bit larger as well, so they can keep any people aboard. So it's not quite clear. I mean, you might get a mother ship only to find out that it's registered to, you know, to someone in Europe or something, and it wouldn't be registered to anyone in Somalia.
Okay, so once again, a very difficult situation to parse through. You're waiting for the Maersk Alabama to return to Mombasa, the Bainbridge, rather, excuse me, who then they have a pirate aboard.
That's right. The Bainbridge is bringing Captain Phillips and the pirate as well. We just spoke to the local representative from Maersk, and they tell us that Captain Phillips will arrive within probably sometime tomorrow morning, which is approaching quickly here in Kenya. And then he'll be sent to the U.S. after being, debriefed by the FBI.
Shashank Bengali, good to have you with us. Thanks again.
Thank you, Warren.
Africa correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers, now in Mombasa. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Gary Scott and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.